This is a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station.
Welcome to Health and Living with me, T. Xiaoyik. This is NCD Chronicles, a series where we go beyond the disease diagnosis to look at the lived experiences and real challenges faced by people who have non-communicable diseases. Asthma isn't the first thing you think of when it comes to NCDs, but it definitely fits the bill. It's chronic, typically developing in childhood and persisting for years into adulthood. It's a multifactorial disease related to inflammation in the lungs, but very much influenced by a person's environment and behavior.
I don't remember when was the first time I've had asthma. So my parents tell me I've had it since I was very young. But I've had several episodes of ups and downs with asthma, especially how I managed it. I remember when I was younger, frequent trips to the clinic for nebulizers. And sometimes when I go to my grandparents at Seremban, I'll take a bicycle ride and do an illegal stop. Illegal because I wasn't allowed to my favorite sugarcane stall. Lots of ice, very sweet on a hot day. And 150% I'll get an asthma attack and my grandpa will have to send me to the clinic across the road for my nebs.
That's Sharizal Sharani. He's 46 and a self-described serial entrepreneur. He's currently attached to a government agency that deals with technology. Sharizal's experience of living with asthma has been marked by ups and downs. He attributes it to the way he managed his asthma in the earlier years, or rather, to the mismanagement of his asthma.
So, here's the thing. Nobody told me that you shouldn't use your asthma inhaler more than 3 times a month. And sometimes, I'd be using it 5 times a day, right? And you think it's okay. So, things changed. Number one, in 2005, we were moving house, packed all our stuff to move into the condo. And of course, underneath the rugs and the furniture were dust collected over, I don't know, 15 years, 10 years. And my supposedly smoking but not asthmatic in my mind was inhaling all this. And suddenly I had the worst experience with regards to an asthma attack, and I was hospitalized. And it was during this time that the consultant that was treating me, he said, no cats. I had a cat, by the way, Persian cat. Loved it to bits. No carpets. My house is full of carpets. And no smoking. I'm like, oh, all the three things I kind of love at that time. And he told me that the reason why I've sort of fell off this slope was because my asthma was not under good management. And from that point onwards, he told me that I was going to be on medication for life. One inhaler twice a day, another inhaler for emergency, one tablet once a day for the rest of my life. And off and on, you know, I'll get some other attack and I'll have to add on medication. So it wasn't very pleasant, nor was it cheap. I recall one brand was almost 100 over a ringgit a box, and that would last me a month. So my medication bill was at least, you know, north of 1,500 a year, just on my asthma. So it's a fair bit.
So just how common is this to have people who mismanage their asthma for a significant period of their lives?
I would say the biggest issue, or perhaps one of the more common things that we come across, is people's perception of the inhalers that they use. So some feel that inhalers are unnecessary. Some are afraid of their inhalers. They feel that there is a risk of being addicted or being dependent that's going to weaken your lungs. And this is a very, very common perception amongst parents, amongst patients.
That's Dr. Helmi Hajamaidin, a consultant respiratory physician at a private hospital in Klang Valley. He's also the co-founder of Asthma Malaysia, an online portal aiming to provide resources for patients and healthcare workers.
From a medical perspective, we actually have the opposite view, because if I can take a step back, asthma, essentially, if I were to distill it to a very simple way of thinking about it, is where you have more inflamed lungs. So there is some underlying inflammation that makes the lung more sensitive to triggers from your surroundings. Now, one way of trying to improve your symptoms would be to reduce exposure to these triggers, but that's not always easy because the triggers could be anything from dust to cat to the weather. But the more important thing from a medical perspective is to reduce the underlying inflammation. And this is where having the preventer or the regular inhalers come into play. Now, the key type of inhaler that does this contains steroids. And sometimes when we talk about or we use the word steroids, everyone goes into a panic because they start worrying about side effects like putting on weight, stunting of growth, diabetes. But these are things that are only applicable to stronger oral or intravenous type steroids and are not applicable at all to the inhaled type of steroids. So the key message here is your inhaled steroids are very, very safe in terms of long-term side effects. But more importantly, these are the inhalers that actually control your asthma. These are the inhalers that actually saves lives. So anybody who has got asthma, the thing that makes the biggest difference would be your inhaled steroids.
Shahrizal had been using his emergency inhaler up to 5 times a day, which is a major red flag that his lung airways were continuously becoming more and more inflamed, even as he continued with his daily life.
The inhalers that you use for emergency use contain something called a beta agonist. And what it does is it immediately opens up your airways. The thinking behind that is when you have an attack, your airways become even more constricted. So oxygen or air can't go in and you need something to give you that immediate relief. And these beta agonists do that. It works very quickly. It's similar to what some people get at GPs via nebulization, but it's not something long lasting and it's not something that addresses the underlying inflammation. So if you find yourself needing a inhaler to address an emergency or an attack once in a blue moon, I'm talking about say once a week, for example, and it's an obvious trigger, then you probably can do with that particular inhaler as and when required. But if you're finding yourself having to use it repeatedly, or you're finding yourself that the frequency is increasing, or you're suddenly becoming more and more sensitive to triggers around you, that's a sign that the underlying issue has not been addressed adequately. And you need to think of something else besides that inhaler that you use on a PRN or as and when required.
I asked Shahrizal why he went for so many years without being given the right information or support.
So if I recall, whenever we made the trips to the GP, it was, you know, take a nap, no cold drinks, try not to have carpets at home. It's always the standard advice. I don't recall any sharing of materials, how to manage the asthma, nor there was any advice for us to get in touch with a regular physician as a specialist in asthma? Because I think they would have helped, because my parents would have depended on what the GP advised, right? I recall it was always the same kind of advice. So I don't think I can blame my parents so much. You know, during that time, there's no internet. You can't Google your way out of symptoms, although it's a dangerous thing now because not everybody thinks they're better than their physician. And they were very limited, right, in terms of exposure to different types of managing asthma and what kind of impact that could happen to their child if they don't manage it. So I think in their minds, even in my mind, I think we were doing as what was prescribed. But maybe also at that time, the knowledge on how to manage asthma is not as sophisticated and as developed as it is now. But all I can say was, I think at that time, my parents were managing it the best way they can, according to the input and knowledge they had.
We've had asthma with us for centuries, right? Things like asthma being triggered by flour from the baker, that's something that we've known from even 5-6 centuries ago. But the mechanism of inflammation is only something that's been around for maybe 2-3 decades. And most people don't see asthma as a chronic disease. Most people feel that there's a cure. Sometimes people feel that kids will, you know, quote unquote, grow out of it, which is not necessarily true. And unlike things like hypertension, diabetes, it's very difficult to diagnose asthma. It's not as straightforward. So sometimes we underdiagnose it. So for example, if you look at, say, hypertension, there is a figure that you aim for. If it's above, say, 140 over 90 or 130 over 80, depending on your patient, then you know you can give a diagnosis. With asthma, the bulk of diagnosis is still from the clinical history. So it is relatively subjective. It is dependent on the patient giving the right information. It is dependent on the doctor knowing what information to look for. So it's not as straightforward. And because of that, there is a lot of perception, or lots of differences in perception as well, in terms of what actually constitutes asthma, what are the right approach and treatment for it.
The one thing that Sharizal did know was that he shouldn't have started smoking, but he did anyway.
When I was older, when I was in university, I actually picked up smoking. And surprisingly, it did not impact my health somehow. And that sort of gave me a placebo, thinking that my smoking didn't have an impact on my asthma. And meanwhile, while I stopped smoking for a while because of the scare, but after a while, that habit picked up again. And, you know, I used to have this very popular saying, I think very popular among smokers, you know, quitting is easy. I've done it so many times. So I really didn't have the willpower or the need, I guess, to just quit. Until one day, I think this was around 2012, I was doing some work that was very stressful. And it involved me being locked up in a room with other business partners trying to seal a deal, right? And because we were in a hotel conference room, you weren't allowed to smoke indoors, right? Because usually you would have a break and then go outside, have a cigarette. But that particular day, we just had to finish everything and we were doing everything inside. No time for a cigarette, right? And when I managed to complete that task that day with my colleagues, I just realized, I know, I had an epiphany. This was the most stressful day of my life, and I didn't have a cigarette. So what I did was I went back to my parents-in-law over a U-turn. I saw a little dustbin. It was a traffic light, and then I just chucked my cigarette into it, and that was it, and I quit.
Was there not one moment when you thought, gosh, actually I have asthma, right?
Surely all the time. All the time. And I always say, like, wow, I have asthma and why am I not wheezing? Why am I not coughing? So I was like, you know, Mr. Cowboy, right? Looking cool and feeling cool. Well, at that time, like when I was 18. And that developed to like this excuse, oh, I need it because I can increase metabolism, helps with my stress, so on and so forth, or gets me into social networks, stuff like that, right? To me, now it does seem a little naive for me to have thought about it that way. And that was when I learned, well, I should have known. My consultant said, if you needed to use your emergency inhaler more than 3 times a month, I mean, additionally, as an emergency, then your asthma is not well managed. So then he started a routine. I can continue with my inhaler, but use it twice daily, 2 puffs in the morning, 2 puffs at night. And that was it. I do know that in order to manage my asthma, I will still need to have that in my pocket so that if anything happens, because I know my trigger points, such as smoke, sudden change in temperature, cigarette smoke, for some reason now, that triggers it. And very, very dusty places or sudden decrease or increase in temperature, that triggers it too. But yeah, that's the sort of the journey that I went through. Very long and interesting.
So what can be done to help people with asthma handle their condition better? We'll come back to hear more from Sharizal and Dr. Helmi. This is NCD Chronicles, a series that takes you beyond the diagnosis of non-communicable diseases to understand the unique struggles and needs of the individuals behind the disease. Stay tuned to Health and Living, BFM 89.9. Hello and welcome back to Health and Living. I'm T. Xiao Yik, and this is NCD Chronicles, a series that explores the NCD epidemic through the voices of people living with these chronic diseases. On this episode, Sharizal Sharani speaks to me about living with asthma, which was not properly treated when he was growing up. Reflecting back, he thinks about how different his childhood could have been with a different approach to his disease.
So, my regret being an adult now was that I didn't understand the impact of me not managing my asthma better. So, when I was a child, I remembered that asthma became a problem when I wanted to be active in sports, swimming or running or football. And because it wasn't well managed, I end up huffing and puffing, not even halfway through. So it impeded somehow my social development, if you like, with my peers, right? And I think if I had managed my asthma better then, you know, maybe I would have a different set of life friends because, you know, sports just give a different kind of a fraternity, right? And maybe I might have been a taller person. I don't know. So, but it did impede my physical activities. And usually it wasn't so serious. It was just shortness of breath. Wheezing is the most common symptoms. Nothing scary. It feels rough inside, funny sound. Sometimes, you know, I'll just breathe in and out harder and faster just to sound a bit more dramatic. And I tell my parents, I cannot go to school. I used to remember when I was learning how to swim and giving asthma as an excuse that I cannot go for my swimming sessions that my parents wanted to pay for. I'm now enjoying swimming a lot more. I can do several laps without feeling tired and huffing and puffing at the end of that session. You feel fitter, healthier, and that does wonders to your confidence. So imagine if you're not managing your asthma when you're young and you're not having this confidence which you can have. I think if you're able to manage your asthma at a younger age and have this confidence in life, I think it'll be a life-changing experience for anyone. And that's why I think, looking back, I strongly advocate for any asthma sufferers who have not gone through the process of managing their asthma right to do it, like today.
That stereotype of the asthmatic child, right, has a bit of a stigma to it, right?
Weak, sickly, and it's not true.
I turned to respiratory physician Dr. Helmi Hajamaidin to find out if things have changed in the 3 to 4 decades since Shahrizal was a kid.
One of the biggest challenges I find, both in terms of patients as well as parents of patients, is they feel that there is a need to pull back from doing physical exercise. So they don't want to trigger the asthma. But once again, the way I would approach it is, I want you to have your asthma well controlled enough that you have a normal life, you're able to do things properly, and you avoid all these issues of increasing body weight, a lack of confidence, especially for children growing up. To me, you know, the vast majority of children, for example, should not be skipping PE. We should not have to write a letter to the teacher to say, so-and-so has got asthma and therefore needs to be excused. It's all about the underlying control.
So kids today shouldn't have to grow up like Shahrizal did, right?
I would hope not, no. I think we have more information today. We have more access to care. I think as time goes by, once again, there'll be less and less stigma when it comes to the disease itself. I still get very irritated when I see movies and, you know, there's this weak kid who has to reach out to the blue inhaler and go, and then suddenly, you know, it's always perceived as a weakness, right? It's never a superhero taking a puff before she goes off to fly off and, you know, do something. So I think over time, there has to be a lot of perception change, both in terms of how we treat these things in society, but also, you know, in popular media.
Perceptions are not harmless. Perceptions are what drive people to think of asthma as an occasional allergic reaction that they can self-medicate against. But 90% of asthma cases in Malaysia are uncontrolled. And over 1% of people with asthma in Malaysia have died of asthma-related complications. That's when the airways swell up so much that no matter how much you puff on the inhaler, there just isn't enough air getting into your lungs.
I think some people do have that kind of attitude, you know, oh, don't go to the doctor, just invest in a nebulizer, put it at home, right? I think for people who are chronic, who are serious sort of asthmatic patients, sure, you might need to have that as a last resort. And only if you are seeing a regular physician or specialist and that advise you to do so. But if you haven't done so, you might be going off the wrong track and you don't know it, right, until it's too late. I think that's something that we shouldn't do. I know that seeing a private specialist is expensive, but there are specialists within the government healthcare as well. Because I know when I was hospitalized, I was in a government healthcare institution and they're equally good. So I do suggest if you can't go see a private specialist, at the very least, take a day off and queue up to see the public healthcare specialist.
Shahrezal's care and, in fact, his life changed when he saw a specialist for the first time. But Dr. Helmi says this doesn't have to be the case for patients if they are appropriately managed by a GP or a primary care physician from the start.
I would say that for most chronic diseases, and it's asthma, diabetes, hypertension, even stable cardiac diseases, the bulk of management should be at the primary care level. Because if you have a GP, if you have a family physician or family medicine practitioner who is able to access care, is able to access the right treatment, is adequately trained to look at things at its more basic level, then you would be able to treat these things very, very simply and very, very straightforwardly at the primary care level. The caveat to that is there will always be a number of individuals who, despite having these treatment on board, will not be able to achieve the control that we would like them to have. And knowing when to refer these patients is another key element onto secondary or even tertiary care.
But systemic barriers still stand in the way of being able to shift the management of asthma to primary care settings.
I would say that at the national level, there is still limited access to proper asthma diagnosis, especially in the primary care setting. More than 90% of asthma patients do not have spirometric testing at diagnosis and follow-up visits in our clinic kesihatan. A spirometry is a machine that essentially measures your lung function, your lung capacity. And it's one way of giving some form of data and information to the doctor with regards to the control of asthma and in terms of the response to particular forms of treatment. Now, when there's the inavailability of such things, when you have clinic spaces in the clinic kesihatan where there isn't as much space, where you do not have dedicated asthma teams in most primary care clinics in Malaysia, then you're going to have these problems I mentioned earlier on about the underdiagnosis of asthma. So once again, it's a, as you pointed out, it's more of a systemic issue, right? It's a capacity issue. In an ideal world, I would argue that most asthma cases can and should be managed at the primary care setting. But this is very much dependent on the availability of resources, both in terms of the actual devices and equipment, but also the adequate skills mix when it comes to the doctors or the medical officers who are dealing with the patients on a day-to-day basis.
So what would you like to advocate for in terms of building that capacity?
Oh, more money for asthma care. Every single specialty, I think, is going to advocate for that. But if we were to be objective, and I'll say this as a lung doctor talking about asthma, so I'll try to be as objective as possible. But I think what we need to do is we need to recognize that asthma is a NCD that requires as much attention as the other NCDs that we keep talking about. Because in Malaysia, there is a tendency to focus on hypertension, on diabetes, on heart disease. And not to say that these are not important things, but there are also approximately almost 3 million Malaysians who do have asthma. And we look at respiratory care as a whole, because if I were to take a step back and look at how spirometry, for example, is not only for asthma, but also for conditions like chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or pulmonary fibrosis, and in fact, every other lung disease, you actually find that the bulk and the majority of cases being presented to the emergency department is actually respiratory in nature. And respiratory diseases cause, I think, the second highest number of deaths in Malaysia. So I think it's high time that we actually put a bit more attention, both once again in terms of what we're doing today, which is advocacy and education, but also in terms of resources and funding for the colleagues of mine who are, I think, in far more dire circumstances than I am when it comes to the ability to access these facilities.
So when it comes to access, what are the gaps when it comes to ensuring that treatment is affordable and accessible for individuals?
There are two elements to that. I think one, as a whole, the system needs to be provided with more funds. Recently, YB Kyrie mentioned how we are advocating or we are lobbying for the government to give us more funding so that we achieve 5% of GDP in terms of public health expenditure. So I think that's one key thing. And that additional funding would hopefully, once again, be ring-fenced for some elements or some forms of treatment and management for respiratory medicine as a whole, and asthma in particular. The other thing is, once again, for the vast majority of patients, it should be a case whereby the asthma is controlled with your day-to-day type inhalers. There will be a small number of patients, probably 5% or less, who have more severe forms of asthma, who will then start to require certain types of biologics. So very similar to how the conversation is happening with cancer, for example, where, you know, your first and second line treatment may not be working as well as you'd like it to, and then you come into a sudden level where the cost escalates. Now, I think this is where a way to look at the funding mechanism has to be put in place, especially when you are looking at the cost of the medication versus the cost to productivity, as well as the cost to the hospital system when it comes to repeated admissions. So sometimes it's not, when we do analysis, we don't always look at the kind of overall cost. It's just like, ubat ni mahal, so tak boleh. It should be more a case of this medication, yes, it's expensive, but actually look, you may be spending, say, 10,000 a month, but this actually saves you the cost of admissions, which may be 50, 60,000 a month, depending on the patient, of course.
But surely 10,000 ringgit a month is still steep by any measure.
Now, once again, like I mentioned, this is for the vast minority of patients, but these are medications that they may not be something that is suitable for the vast majority of patients, but for the patients who actually do benefit from it, you can see a vast improvement in their outcomes. So to put things into context, you may have a patient who has been on inhalers, who has been taking oral steroids, which we mentioned earlier is the one that we want to avoid because of the side effects. But despite all that, they get recurrent attacks or the asthma is not well controlled. And if you do certain types of blood tests, you may find that these people are amenable to better outcomes if they were given certain types of biologics. And this is the cohort of patients that would actually do very well if you give them the medication. So it's not something that you'd give everyone. It's not something that you should give it as a first or even second line. It's something that you have to be very, very choosy about. But when those patients are identified, then how do we help them pay for such a high or rather expensive drug? I find that if we are able to justify it, then the insurance companies are actually quite amenable to it, because once again, they would look at the cost of the medication versus the cost of recurrent admissions. And if you have a patient who has been getting admitted, say, 2, 3, or even 4 times a year, and sometimes requiring up to high dependency or ICU care, that's going to be far more expensive than spending something on a regular basis to prevent these things from happening.
Numbers matter, whether you're the federal government funding the healthcare budget, a public health authority allocating resources to different disease areas, or a healthcare provider identifying why patients are coming in with severe attacks or even dying. Dr. Helmi talks about his wish list for better data collection in Malaysia.
I would like to have a system that is similar to Australia and UK, where data is easily accessible to practitioners as well as to patients outside. So I think things, simple things, for example, like the number of asthma patients that are currently here, a database where we can identify severe asthma patients, knowing who is dying from asthma. And the reason I say that is because if you look at the UK, a number of years ago, they did this very interesting exercise where for over a period of 12 months, every single person who died of asthma was identified in the UK. And this wasn't to find fault in terms of individual practice. This was to identify why were these patients dying? What was the fault in the system that prevented them from staying alive? And we found out that essentially, you know, easily 50% of those cases were preventable because of simple things like not using the inhaler properly, not having an asthma action plan, not going to the GP when necessary, not going to a specialist when necessary. So lots and lots of preventable stuff, which actually does not take much resource or money to actually improve upon. So sometimes we are very, I suppose, excited about new things to do to reinvigorate the system and so on and so forth. But actually what we sometimes need is a snapshot of how things are really at this point in time so that then we can work backwards and improve on those little things. And I'm sure in the Malaysian context, we have lots of low-hanging fruits that we can improve upon. The Malaysian Thoracic Society, which is a society consisting of all the respiratory specialists in the country, they have kept severe asthma databases in the past. I think what has been a problem in the past has been funding, because if you want to keep a database, it's not cheap. You need access to patients, you need people to chip in, you need the software, you need to make sure the data is adequately protected. So it's not as simple as creating a spreadsheet. Now, what tends to happen is there may be periods of time where there is interest by potential funders to actually fund or sponsor such a database. But once the interest is lost or the next round of budgeting happens, then these things may be taken away. So these things are then not up to date.
If we look at the experiences and challenges of people with asthma like yourself, would you say the healthcare system in Malaysia is supportive of your needs?
So I'll say this. Maybe I'm privileged to have met the right physicians or been exposed to doctors who've pointed me to the right things to read, right? I think in that sense, our healthcare has served me adequately. But maybe I'm coming from a privileged point of view. So those who are less privileged, I feel there should be more awareness campaigns. To me, I feel that that's not enough, because if I'm only getting news and information through my own personal initiatives and I don't see it elsewhere, not even in social media, in the wider sense, I think there's clearly a gap and we can do more. Associations, NGOs could do more. Maybe there could be more programs in schools so that kids also know, right? The thing is, when kids know about their own health, they tend to advocate the right management to their parents. And similarly, there should be more information that gets consumed by parents today, you know, social media, right? To have these types of awareness content being deployed.
It comes back to the fact that a significant proportion of asthma cases can be well controlled with the right medication and avoidance of triggers.
But there are certain things that are within our control, for example, smoking. And one of the key reasons why I've been a huge advocate of the generational endgame is because I do see asthma patients who feel that they're unable to stop smoking. They feel that they are addicted to it. And despite knowing at a very kind of, you know, cognitively, they know that this is bad for me and this is what's making my asthma worse. Or, you know, over a period of time, they realize that things are not as well as before, but they're just unable to shake things off. And these are risk factors that we have to work hard and we have to, once again, be consistent in trying to get away. And if you look at things in a slightly more, I suppose, global scale, you know, things like air pollution, climate change, these are things that will inevitably and eventually affect our health. And asthma, I think, is like, in some ways, a canary that's in the mine. You're going to get people affected by these things first because you're inhaling these things. And you need to be, we as a society, I think, need to do more to reduce all these risk factors. And this is where I think we can make the biggest difference, both for ourselves and for our children.
I asked Shahrizal whether he fears that his children will also grow up with asthma, that they will experience the kind of problems that he did, struggling to breathe, feeling like he was drowning.
For every parent, when they see a child having breathing difficulties, I think they always fear the worst. And that's the first thing in my mind when I look at my kids. If they have some breathing difficulties or they look like they could be asthmatic, I know quickly that I need to manage it, address it aggressively, right? But yeah, I think my parents, especially my mom, when I had that episode in 2005, I've never seen her cross red lights ever. And she, I think she, that night, she crossed like 7 traffic lights that were red. So I think parents will feel super anxious and they will fear the worst, especially you when you say, I can't breathe, right? And I think if my kids do that to me, I'll be scared, really scared.
And for that reason, Shahrizal has gone from being a smoker to now the biggest advocate of smoking control, as well as other strategies to promote a healthy lifestyle.
When one person with an NCD is put on the right path towards better control of their disease, they can champion the message and change the course for many others around them. The question now is, do we listen to the canary in the coal mine, or do we let its death be in vain? This has been NCD Chronicles, a series featuring the experiences and challenges of people with non-communicable diseases. If you missed any part of the show or previous episodes, you can search for it on bfm.my or on our BFM app. You've been listening to Health and Living on BFM 89.9.
You have been listening to a podcast from BFM 89.9, the business station. For more stories of the same kind, download the BFM app.